Okay, so yeah, there's three words in my title here, and these are the three things that I really want to tell you about today. So Heisenberg algebras and Heisenberg categories, Frobenius algebras, and then decategorifying these things. So hopefully by the end, my title will somewhat make sense. So in a little bit more detail, what I'm going to talk about today is I'll define a Heisenberg algebra as I think of it anyway. And then introduce some categories which model this Heisenberg algebra, so some higher mathematical object which somehow controls the structure of this Heisenberg algebra. And then I will discuss a way to sort of extend that construction, a sort of general Heisenberg category, which is has its relations twisted or modified by any Frobenius algebra F. So this is a big unified framework for this categorification business. And then finally, I'll discuss some of my work, which is ways to view decategorifications of these things, so ways to turn the categories back into algebras in interesting ways. And I'll discuss a few ways that I look at that through the lens of something called the trace decategorification. Okay, so to begin with, the Heisenberg algebra. So this was a dangerous slide for me to add when speaking at a physics institute because I am not a physicist. So when I say Heisenberg algebra, I just mean this infinite dimensional Lie algebra. I have a P and a Q for every positive integer. And then I have this central element C. And the relations are just simply everything commutes except the bracket of P and Q. If the indices match, then I get this integer, which is C times N. Or, you know, the central element C times an integer N. So this is sort of like an uncertainty principle kind of thing. You know, we have these operators corresponding to momentum and position that don't commute. And that's as much physics as I'll discuss today. So we're actually interested in an associative version of this algebra. So I'm going to take its universal enveloping algebra. And then this central element C is usually called a central charge. So this is just going to determine, it's going to be sort of a scaling factor on this commutation relation here. So normally we just pick an integer to set that to. So throughout most of my talk, I'll be talking about central charge 1, but this does all extend to an arbitrary central charge. Okay, and so our goal today is to describe a category which has some additional monoidal structure, and I'll explain what I mean by that. That models the relations in this algebra and can tell us something interesting about it. Okay. So just in general, I wanted to give one slide of introduction to this idea of categorification. So this is a word for a general collection of processes that essentially allow us to lift set types objects like groups and rings and algebras up to a category level. So we're going to lift generally elements in our set to objects in our category, and then functions between set type objects to functors between categories. And then, you know, relations, if we have any relations in our set, will be lifted to isomorphisms in the category. So sort of the easiest example you can think of this is just finite dimensional vector spaces over a field. I've chosen the complex numbers here, but for no reason. And that categorifies the natural numbers simply because a finite dimensional vector space is determined up to isomorphism by its dimension. So I can just take the dimension and get down to this set of natural numbers. And I guess this is not a terribly interesting categorification, but something interesting we can note is that some of the algebraic properties of the natural numbers, like how we add or multiply natural numbers, are lifted to natural structures in the category, like taking direct sum of vector spaces or tensor product of vector spaces. Okay. So the reason that we would do this is that when we categorify something, we're adding all of this information about morphisms in the category. So in the natural numbers, if I have two numbers, the only ways I can compare them are less than, equal to, or greater than. Whereas if I have two vector spaces, one of which has smaller dimension, then I have a whole additional vector space telling me about all of the ways to map this smaller space into the bigger space. So we really expand the horizon of our information quite a bit. Okay. So we're looking for a categorification of the Heisenberg algebra, but to do that, just taking the dimension of something isn't really going to cut it for us. We need some more intricate structure. So these maps that take me from a category down, back down to an algebra or another set type object, these are called decategorification maps. So the most common one in representation theory, which is the field we're talking about really today, is called the Grothendieck group. So to define this, we just take a free abelian group generated by isomorphism classes of objects in our category. And then we just add the one additional relation that direct sum in the category is actual sum in the Grothendieck group. So of course, we need whatever assumptions on our category we need to define this direct sum operation. So all of my categories are linear in this talk. Okay, so this is our Grothendieck group, or really it's the split Grothendieck group. And this is going to allow us to categorify the Heisenberg algebra. Okay. All right, so, but this Grothendieck group, this only has this one operation, which is addition. And again, that's really not enough to really get at everything we need to categorify in the Heisenberg algebra. So we need to add yet a bit more structure to our category. We want it to be a monoidal category. So a monoidal category means that I have a notion of tensor product. I have this bifunctor called tensor product that takes me from two copies of my category down to one. And I have these equalities which basically tell me that the tensor product behaves nicely enough to treat it like an actual tensor product. So it's associative, and there's a monoidal identity object, one. Okay. And so I've labeled this as a strict monoidal category, and in this case it's strict because instead of isomorphism in the middle here, I have actual equality. So these are on-the-nose equalities and not just some weird isomorphisms. And this allows us to avoid talking about coherence conditions and other things like that, which make this picture a lot more complicated. Okay. So the advantage of this is if we have a monoidal category, then that structure lifts to the Grothendieck group in a nice way. So I can use that to define a product on the Grothendieck group where I just multiply two isomorphism classes by taking the tensor product of their representatives. And there's something to prove here that this is well-defined, but it is. So this allows us to define now a Grothendieck ring. And finally, this is enough structure to now talk about this associative algebra that we want to categorify. So our goal is to, for the first part of this talk, is to define this category Heis, which when we take this Grothendieck ring, will give us this associative algebra at a certain central charge. Okay. Okay. So the way we're going to define this category is with an algebra of planar diagrammatics. So we're gonna use some string diagrams to talk about morphisms in our category. So there's a general framework for defining monoidal categories using string diagrams. And the idea is that we represent morphisms by drawing strands, where at the bottom I have the source of the morphism and at the top I have the target. And then I'll put some token or some other drawing in the middle of the strand to indicate that a morphism is being applied there. Okay. And then if I want to compose morphisms, there's two ways that I can do this in a monoidal category. I can either literally compose the maps, and in that case, I'll denote that by vertical stacking. So we just go from A to B by going through both of these bubbles, F and G. Or we could take the tensor product of morphisms and get a morphism from A tensor A to B tensor B, and that's denoted by horizontal stacking or juxtaposition. Okay, so this gives us a framework to talk about every morphism in our category, and moreover, because we have these products, we can talk about generators of an algebra of morphisms. We don't have to literally define every morphism. All right. So here's a sort of simple example of this process. So if we consider a strict monoidal category and it has one object, which I denote by an up arrow. So I identify that with the identity morphism on this object. Okay, then we can add in one generating morphism in our category, which is a crossing. So this is a morphism from the second tensor power of this object to itself. And I should say, so monoidally generated means that a generic object in this category is just a tensor product of n of these strands. So n of these strands written next to each other. Okay, so this is our generating morphism, and we can impose a few relations on this to make things a little bit more interesting. So I can mandate, for instance, that if I compose this generating morphism with itself, then I get the identity on the tensor product of two objects, and I can impose this braid relation that says if I have three objects and I apply this morphism in various ways, then those actions agree. And if I do this, then these are exactly the defining relations for the symmetric group, where this generating morphism was just a simple transposition. Okay, so that means that I've now defined a category where my endomorphism spaces of all of my objects are various symmetric groups. So This is sort of going to be a crucial idea in us defining Heisenberg categories, as we really want to control what these endomorphism spaces are and make them correspond to interesting algebras. All right. Okay, so now let's get to a Heisenberg category. So this was constructed by Kovanov in 2010. And here we have actually two monoidal generators, P and Q. So we have an upstrand and a downstrand. And these, of course, are going to correspond to the generators P and Q of the Heisenberg algebra. And so a generic object is a tensor product of P's and Q's. So I have some sequence of up and down strands, and that's all of my objects. Okay, but the interesting thing is I have a lot of generating morphisms now. So I'm going to add a crossing, which sends me from P tensor P to P tensor P. And then I have these cups and caps. And these are all sort of either creation or destruction morphisms. So I'm going to start with a monoidal identity. And so the way we read this is you start at the bottom, go to the top. A strand pointing up is a P, and a strand pointing down is a Q. So in this cup on the bottom, there's no strands pointing in or out. That means I just have a monoidal identity there. And in the top, I have a strand pointing down and a strand pointing up, so I get a Q tensor P. And it's similar for all of these other cups and caps going in various ways. So there's the caps then destroy because we go from P tensor Q to the monoidal identity. Okay. All right. So these are our generating objects and morphisms, and then we impose relations to get the structure that we want of a Heisenberg category. So first of all, yes, but you don't have to include that as one of the generating morphisms. You can actually get that by composing this with various caps and cups. So you
actually can imposing certain relations.
Yeah, so you can start, you can do, hold on, I'll draw something. So if we start with just a crossing like that,
Yes. Then
I can add, how do I want to do this? A couple of cups like that, which tie into the various bottom parts, and a couple of caps. And if I did that the right way, then this should be equal to a down crossing. So something I haven't actually explicitly discussed, I'll get to this in a few slides, is that these diagrams are invariant under isotopy. So when I have some complicated diagram like this, I can just straighten it out.
But that is like an additional relation in clinical situations where doing that, right? There's another way you could do that, and there are categories where you want those to be different.
Right. Yeah. But in this category, they are the same. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So some of the relations we talk about are we get symmetric group relations as long as the strands are pointing in the same direction, and also in one situation where they're pointing in opposite directions. And then generally, though, we get a more interesting relation for if the strands are pointing in the opposite directions. So this is if I start with a Q tensor P and go to Q tensor P. So if I compose two of these crossings, then I get this slightly deformed relation where I get a cup-cap pair as well. Okay. And it's a little bit hard to see right now, and I'm not going to go into too much detail about this, but this is exactly the relation that allows us to get the Heisenberg relation in our category. So this is telling us something about Q tensor P is isomorphic to P tensor Q plus some scalar. So you can sort of think this Q tensor P is this, and then to change this into a P tensor Q, I have to go through this morphism. And so this extra relation is telling me something about I'm left with an identity when I do that. Okay. So we had these symmetric group relations if I'm just looking at strands, but if I add in something corresponding to a polynomial generator, then we can sort of upgrade that to a degenerate affine Heckett algebra. So I can define this right twist curl. And again, this is not a new generating morphism. This curl is just, this right twist curl is strand. Let me make sure that, yeah, doing this in the right way. So this curl is this morphism where I combine cups, caps, and crossings in the correct way. And I get this loop here. So if I do this in the leftward direction, it's one of the defining relations of the category that's zero. But in the right direction, I could just give this a shortcut name and call it a dot. And then we can use the other relations in the category to sort of figure out how this dot behaves. And the most interesting one is that if you pass this dot through a crossing, then you're left with an identity morphism at the end. Yeah?
Suppose I take a representation of a quantum group.
Okay.
And I take some representation of some dual representation. Mm-hmm. Do I get functor from this category? Like where P is an object, Q is a dual object.
It is closely related to that, but the answer is no, because like you can't get a, for the same reason that you can't have a representation of the Heisenberg algebra in a finite dimensional vector space, like you can't have a representation of this category in a symmetric monoidal category, because P and well, in a category where A tensor B is isomorphic to B tensor
okay.
A, right? If you go back a slide, like Q tensor P is not isomorphic to P tensor Q.
Maybe I could take representations of the Yangian.
You're not wrong to think about that and to draw that connection, but like it's a tiny bit more complicated.
I mean, there is a theory of constructing these categories as sort of universal objects somehow. But I'm not sure. You'd have to be careful about exactly what structure you wanted out of it.
Well, you know, you have this parameter C, right? And this is like the level one Heisenberg. So there's also a level zero Heisenberg category. And the standard representation of GLN and its dual generate a representation of the level zero Heisenberg category. And there's quantum version of that, which you can get with quantum GLN. But in general, you have to be kind of careful about, like, because so it's exactly this relation down at the bottom that it, that's saying something quite special about what's going on there.
Okay.
Sorry.
No, that's good. okay, so yeah, this dot, if we pass it through a crossing, leaves us with an identity morphism, and this is exactly the defining relation for the degenerate affine Hecke algebra. So this is sort of telling us that there's a little bit more interesting structure in this category than just the symmetric group. We actually get these Hecke algebras as well. All right. Let's see. Oh, yes. And so if I look at just tensor products of a lot of strands pointing in the same direction in this category, then they are isomorphic to this DHN, this degenerate affine Hecke algebra. Okay, so this is related to that earlier statement about symmetric groups, and now throughout the rest of the talk, I'm going to continue upgrading the things that I get in this endomorphism space here. Okay. So an interesting way to think about this category and an important one for categorification is as acting as functors on modules for the symmetric group. So the way we think about this action is we can send an upstrand to the induction functor and a downstrand to the restriction functor. And then the morphisms in this category are general natural transformations of these induction and restriction functors. So for example, cups and caps are going to be sort of unit co-unit pairs on induction and restriction functors. So this gives us an interesting representation of this category acting on representations for the symmetric group. And this is called the Fock space representation of this category. So something that we get out of this is we know a lot about induction and restriction functors, and in particular, we know that induction and restriction for the symmetric group are biadjoint functors. So we should be able to see that in our category somehow. So the way that biadjunction shows up in this category is through some of these relations that I mentioned earlier. So we have these two straightening relations that tell us that our diagrams are invariant under isotopy. So if I have no crossings, then I can sort of straighten out kinks in my strand and get the same morphism. Okay, and adding these two relations to the category exactly means that this up object is biadjoint to the down object. Okay, so this is exactly the induction restriction biadjointness principle. And so I haven't really described the Fock space representation in enough detail for you to see why this is true, but this corresponds to a unit co-unit definition of biadjointness. So this, these cups and caps are sort of units and co-units, and they tell us these relations tell us that composing those units and co-units give us identity transformations on these functors. Okay. So finally, this Heisenberg category, there's a lot more that we could discuss about it, but I will just say that this was the one thing that we were looking for. So this Heisenberg category categorifies the Heisenberg algebra in the sense that if you take its split Grothendieck group, then you get two. That should probably be a U of H. Yeah, that should be a U of H, sorry. This associative version of the Heisenberg algebra. Yes, and this was conjectured by Kovanov back in 2010, but it was only very recently proved by Brendan Savage and Webster. So it's easy to show, or at least relatively easy to show, that there's an injective map from the Heisenberg algebra into K0 here, but it's relatively difficult to show that that map is surjective. It's hard to sort of compute all of the idempotents in this category and make sure that you've really got everything in this Heisenberg algebra. Okay, so this is the first statement that I wanted to get to in my talk. We have these Heisenberg categories that allow us to categorify Heisenberg algebras, and they also have interesting connections to representation theory through this Fox-based representation. Okay. So now there are variations on this Heisenberg category that various people have defined in the last 10 years since it first appeared. So one of these is the twisted Heisenberg. So to get the twisted Heisenberg, we're just going to add one more morphism, an empty dot on a strand, which corresponds to a grading shift. And we're going to say that this is actually a Z2 grading shift. So if I compose this hollow dot with itself, then I get the identity. Okay, so this is sort of, if we look at endomorphism spaces, then this gives us now degenerate affine Hecke-Clifford algebras. So this hollow dot is sort of the generator of a Clifford algebra. And it turns the Heisenberg category into now a super category. So I have a Z2 grading and everything super commutes instead of commuting. Okay, so this was defined in 2012 by Cowdes and Sussin, and they defined a Fox-based representation for it as well. And it has, right, so whereas the Heisenberg category acted on modules for the symmetric group, this acts on modules for Sergeyev algebras, which are Hecke-Clifford algebras. Okay, so sort of tensoring the symmetric group with the Clifford algebra. Okay. All right, so we have both a classical Heisenberg category and this twisted case. And there's a lot more Heisenberg categories that have been defined as well, which I haven't listed here, but we can associate Heisenberg categories that act on modules over zigzag algebras and over normal Hecke algebras without the degenerate requirement here. So sort of a natural question is, can we generalize this construction? What's the most general possible way that we can unify all of these Heisenberg categories together? So the one thing that we really need to define this category is we want these two objects to be biadjoint. So we have two monoidal generating objects and we want them to be biadjoint. And as I said earlier, this is just defined to mean that we have these morphisms, which are cups and caps, and we have straightening relations like these. And it turns out that this is sort of the minimal amount of structure that you need to define Kovanov's Heisenberg category. So in any other Heisenberg category that we want to define, we should first of all have some sort of Fox-based representation, some way for that category to act on modules as induction and restriction functors. And we should second of all have that the induction functor in that module category is biadjoint to the restriction functor.
These mean the two objects are left and right to each other.
I'm sorry.
Two objects are left and right to each other.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, okay, so if we want biadjointness, then we should think about what's going to go in these endomorphism spaces. So what modules do these things act on? So in general, what's the most general algebra that I can define where in the module category over that algebra, induction and restriction are biadjoint functors? And that brings us to the second thread of my talk, which are Frobenius algebras. So the algebras for which induction and restriction are biadjoint functors are exactly Frobenius algebras. So to me, a Frobenius algebra just means that I have a linear trace map and it's non-degenerate, sort of in the usual sense. So another way to say this is we have a non-degenerate bilinear form. These two definitions are equivalent to each other. Okay. So this is a very, very broad class of algebras. So I'll go through some examples in the next two slides, but in some sense, this is telling us that there are a lot of Heisenberg categories, and we shouldn't try to define them piecemeal because that would get very onerous. So the easiest example is just the field itself is a Frobenius algebra, and its trace map is just the identity. And this is non-degenerate. Another less trivial example is any matrix algebra over a field, and the trace map there is just the usual actual trace map, taking the trace of a matrix. So I mentioned the Clifford algebra earlier, so here's a definition of that algebra. The Clifford algebra is this, with one generator, is this two-dimensional vector space generated by 1 and C, and then C squared is defined to be 1. Okay, so it's just K of C mod C squared minus 1. And this is a Frobenius algebra, and the trace map sends this Clifford generator to 0, and it sends 1 to 1. So this actually brings up another interesting point, which is that there are Frobenius super algebras as well. So the Clifford algebra is a Z2 graded algebra where this generator C is odd and the field is even. And then this trace definition actually follows from the fact that if we have a super algebra, we require this trace map to be even. So it kills all the odd parts.
This is not, in the usual definition, this is not a Frobenius super algebra. The trace does not kill the commutators.
Interesting.
Okay. C commutator with C is 1.
Right. Okay.
So that wasn't part of your definition, that trace kills commutators?
No. So I'm not even requiring that my trace is... Oh, I see what you're saying. Oh, so you want like trace of FG to be trace of GF.
No, that's symmetric Frobenius.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, this is not a symmetric Frobenius algebra. It has...
Well, there are Frobenius algebras where it's not symmetric.
Yeah, in fact, I'll discuss the broadest case for that on the next slide. Right, so this has a Nakayama, so it's not symmetric. Okay, and then finally, all group algebras for finite groups are Frobenius algebras. So the trace map, you can fix any element of the group, and then the trace sort of just pulls out the component of that element in this group algebra. So usually you say that H is equal to 1, and then the trace of any element in the group algebra is just the component of the identity element of the group. Okay, so we have lots of Frobenius algebras and lots of other interesting ones which I haven't defined. So Frobenius algebras come equipped with this Nakayama automorphism, and this is the automorphism that makes it not like a usual trace on matrices. So the trace of FG is the trace of G psi of F, where psi is some automorphism. And if this psi is identity, so then trace does actually kill commutators, then F is called a symmetric Frobenius algebra. Okay. So here's all of the examples I gave you and their Nakayama automorphisms. So matrices and the field are symmetric Frobenius algebras, and they're used to trace on matrices kills commutators. So that's good. The Clifford algebra is not, so it reverses the sign on C, and that's exactly what you need for it to kill that commutator then, because then it then the supercommutator of C and minus C is 0. And then in the group algebra, the Nakayama conjugates by the element that we've chosen. So if we do choose the identity element to define our trace map, then the Nakayama is the identity. And so then group algebra is also symmetric with that definition. Okay. And there's a weird requirement which messes up most of what I'm going to say later if we don't make it, which is that this Nakayama automorphism has finite order, usually, and we require that the characteristic of the field does not divide the order of the Nakayama. In fact, you have to work pretty hard to find Nakayama automorphisms which do not have order 2. So most of the time we're saying that the characteristic of our field is not 2. But in general, we could just...
have an example work.
Well, yeah, that's true. That is, I guess, one example of that. But most of the other ones, I mean, virtually all the time when you're talking about the group algebra as a Frobenius algebra, you want it to be symmetric. So that's sort of...
Yeah. Technically, is this automorphism...
How uniquely is it defined?
I've taken any.
So remember, the trace kills anything that's not C. Let's see.
Yeah, I won't.
Okay.
This seems to say that it's super symmetric.
Right. Yeah, sorry, okay. So for super algebras, I was not including that. Sorry, I should modify this slightly.
Oh.
We should have a super symmetry relation. So trace of FG is minus one to the parity of F times the parity of G, trace of G psi F.
So do you really, but I guess what I'm asking is,
yeah.
Does that formula mean that the Clifford algebra is supersymmetric or that it's not supersymmetric, but it would be symmetric if you just thought about it as the group algebra of Z2?
Let me think.
The Clifford algebra is not supersymmetric.
Right, but it's symmetric if you forget about like
yes.
super stuff. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, so the Frobenius algebras are not quite enough actually to allow us to generalize Heisenberg categories. So in the normal Heisenberg category in my endomorphism space, I didn't have symmetric groups. I had these degenerate affine Hecke algebras. And in the twisted case, I had these degenerate affine Hecke Clifford algebras. So I need to generalize that construction as well to be twisted by a Frobenius algebra somehow. So we have always an action of the symmetric group on the nth tensor power of our Frobenius algebra just by permuting the factors or by super permuting the factors if we have a Z2 grading. And so that allows us to define a Reith product algebra, which is just the normal sort of Reith product or normal semi-direct product of F tensor N and KSN. And we can finally lift that to an affine setting by tensoring also by a polynomial algebra. So if we do all three of these things, we get the affine Reith product algebra, ANF. Okay, and the multiplication here is just if I want to move a polynomial generator xi past an f that's in the ith tensor factor, then I have to hit that f with the Nakayama automorphism. And then we also have this degenerate affine Hecke type relation between the Sn part and the polynomial part.
Yeah. It's Nakayama, like I should think of Nakayama as doing a 360-degree rotation of my picture, and so that relation comes from the fact that I'm going around a curl when I commute past a dot.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yes, yeah. So in the diagrammatic realization of the trace, the Nakayama is going all the way around, and yeah, that's exactly when you move a token past a dot, you get a Nakayama.
I mean, in this diagram, it's literally true that the Nakayama is.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so either way, this is saying either way you go, if you go over the dot or around the annulus, you get the Nakayama. Yeah. Okay. This generalizes our construction of the degenerate affine Hecke algebra, and this is going to be the algebra which actually sits in the endomorphism spaces of our category. Okay. All right, so now we can define Frobenius Heisenberg categories. That I'm not going to go into. There's a very intricate, beautiful definition that makes all of these morphisms work. But essentially, the idea is we just add tokens, these colored solid dots, which correspond to all of the elements of our Frobenius algebra. And if I have two tokens being composed, then I just use the multiplication in the Frobenius algebra to combine those dots. Okay. And so this is our generating morphism, and we add relations, which mean that the endomorphism algebras are these affine Reith product algebras. So if I move one of these tokens past a solid dot, past a right twist curl, then I pick up a Nakayama automorphism. Okay. Exactly. So if we look at the endomorphisms of n strands, then we get these affine Reith product algebras. Okay. So these were constructed by Alistair Savage, and conjecturally they categorify lattice Heisenberg algebras, which are essentially Heisenberg tensor a Frobenius. It's a Frobenius version of a Heisenberg algebra. And this conjecture is stuck in the place that the previous conjecture was stuck until last year, in that we have an injective map from these lattice Heisenberg algebras to K0 of this Frobenius Heisenberg, but we don't know that it's surjective. All right, so now we've done two of the things that I promised in my title. So I've talked about Heisenberg algebras and categories, how to extend that to now be deformed by any Frobenius algebra. So finally, I want to talk about ways that I think of these categories in order to pull out some more interesting information from them. So this is through the perspective of something called trace decategorification. And again, this can be k-linear. I just like thinking about characteristic zero fields. But if we have a k-linear additive category, then its trace is the sum of all of its endomorphism spaces modulo any commutators of morphisms. As long as those morphisms have compatible domains and ranges, resources and targets, then I can mod out by their commutator. All right. So if C is just linear, then these endomorphism spaces are just vector spaces, and I'm just taking a span of these commutators, not anything generated by them. So this trace is just a vector space a priori. But we can, once again, make it into a ring if our category is monoidal. So if I have this tensor product, then this span of FG of commutators of F and G is actually a monoidal ideal, and then I'm actually getting an algebra out of this because my endomorphism spaces are also algebras. Okay. So now it's natural to look at interesting categorifications that were sort of defined with respect to the Grothendieck group and ask, do we get other interesting algebras out of them if we take the trace, or do they end up being the same? And I should say, though I didn't write it here, is that the relationship is usually that there is an injective map from the Grothendieck group to the trace, usually. So we can define a map from Grothendieck group into trace, and it just sends the isomorphism class of an object, which is one of the elements of the Grothendieck group, to the trace class of the identity morphism of that object. So if there are a lot of relations that make our identity morphisms commutators, then we're going to run into some issues. So this is almost always in any reasonable category injective, but I think there are cases you can write down where the trace ends up being zero or something. Grothendieck group is not. Yeah, but it can certainly fail to be surjective and often does.
Somehow, like, the issues with injectivity are like, if you have a category where your over characteristic P field and the endomorphisms of a simple object are a division algebra of degree P, then.
Yeah.
Actually, it's a little more simple. You take an elliptic curve. You know, the way you define the Grothendieck group, this, all the points are different, but the Hall-Tune homology is two dimensional, I guess.
Okay. Yeah.
Interesting. That's a good example. Right, yeah, this trace is also the zeroth Hochschild homology of this category. Okay. All right, so I just wanted to walk through one example that shows that we can get sort of extra structure when we do this. So if we look at these, so they have a categorification of a quantum group by Kovanov, Lauda, and Rouquier separately. So they constructed a two-category, actually, U of G, associated to any Kotzmodi algebra G, such that if you take the Grothendieck group of the Kurubi envelope of that category, then you get down to the idempotent form of the quantum group associated to that Kotzmodi algebra. Okay. So if you apply the trace to this same construction, this was done in two steps by Belyakova, oops, missing A there, Belyakova, Habero, Lauda, Webster, and Zivkovich. If you take the trace of this, then you actually get to the idempotent form of a current algebra. So you get sort of this bigger affine thing. I was going to mention one other interesting technical advantage is, like I mentioned up here, before we take the Grothendieck group of the quantum categorified quantum group, we technically have to take its Kurubi envelope, which is this process of adding a bunch of idempotents in, and it sort of breaks the diagrammatics of this category. And one advantage of the trace is that it's actually invariant under passage to the Kurubi envelope. So this business of adding a bunch of idempotents never has to bother you. And this makes it somewhat better suited to looking at diagrammatic categories. Okay. Ben disagrees, maybe. All right. So there's a nice diagrammatic realization of the trace, which is another good reason to apply it to a diagram category. And all we have to do is connect the tops of our string diagrams to the bottoms and punch a hole in the middle. So now we're drawing our diagrams on annuli instead of just on the plane. And then you allow morphisms to slide around the annulus, maybe with some relations after doing that, like in this Heisenberg category. But generally, this since vertical stacking corresponds to composition, this is exactly telling us that F composed with G is equal to G composed with F. And you have to be a little bit careful if your category is Z2 graded, then maybe you want this to actually be a super relation here, so you get a minus one. And in our Frobenius Heisenberg categories, we're going to want to apply a Nakayama automorphism after we do this. But generally speaking, this is how we visualize. Okay, and I've already done this once, I think, but anything drawn in brackets just means I'm taking its trace class. So these are actually drawn on annuli. Okay. All right, so this has been applied to various Heisenberg categories in the past. So Kaudis, Lauda, Licata, and Sussin in 2016 computed the trace of Kovanov's Heisenberg category, and they showed that it's isomorphic to this algebra W1 plus infinity. So this is yet another infinite dimensional Lie algebra that is relevant to people who think about physics, I think, but to me is just the Lie algebra of differential operators on the circle. And yeah, we actually take its enveloping algebra again so that we get this nice associative algebra. And the way this proof goes is going to be echoed in what things we look at later is both sides of this isomorphism have a faithful Fock space representation. They act faithfully on some infinite dimensional vector space. And those Fock space representations are isomorphic. So we can actually just look in this one Fock space representation and try to identify the images of these two algebras and use that to match up the generators between them. Okay. And so if we look at this twisted case, which was the other Heisenberg algebra that I explicitly defined. So we're adding this degree one morphism of a hollow dot, which composes to the identity and which super commutes with itself. Then this gives us the twisted Heisenberg category, and I computed, along with Chan Oges, that the trace of this is isomorphic to a subalgebra of W1 plus infinity called W minus. And this algebra has a sort of complicated definition that's not very enlightening, but essentially W1 plus infinity is some sort of infinite type A construction, something like GL infinity, and this subalgebra W minus is a subalgebra which allows us to look at type B, C, D constructions inside of there. So that was the context in which it was originally defined. And once again, we have Fock space representations on both sides here, and we use that faithful representation to match up the generators.
So the second generator there, is that supposed to be that it's cycled around one?
No, this second relation, so these are not in the trace. There's no annulus here. So I'm just saying if we slide hollow dots past each other, then we get pick up a minus sign.
Okay,
so this is super commuting because these are both odd. If these were in the trace and you slid a hollow dot all the way around, then we would also want a minus sign there. So that's why we apply Nakayama automorphisms when we slide around the annulus. Okay. Okay, so now again, we have these two trace computations for these very specific Heisenberg categories. And we want to generalize this to this broadest possible case of the Frobenius Heisenberg. Okay, so I'll describe a little bit about ways that we can start to get a handle on what that would look like. So to do that, I have to now decategorify this notion of trace from trace of a category to trace of an algebra. And so the trace of an algebra is just the algebra mod the linear span of all of its commutators. So it's sort of an abelianization idea. And so as was described earlier, if we apply this to the Clifford algebra, two of my commutators are zero, and then this third commutator of something with itself, we think that should also be zero, but in fact, because we have this Z2 grading, we want to super commute here. And so C and C are both odd, so this commutator is actually C squared plus C squared. So it's equal to two, but you know, we get a scalar out of that commutator. Okay, so if we look at the trace of this Clifford algebra, it's this algebra mod the field. So we end up with just a one-dimensional vector space, which is the span of this odd generator C. Okay, so the idea is that the trace of these affine Riesz product algebras are going to be sort of a key to understanding the trace of the Frobenius Heisenberg. So first of all, we have a triangular decomposition in all of these Heisenberg categories, which is that we can prove that all of our indecomposable objects can be written in this form. So we have some sequence of up arrows at the start some sequence of down arrows after that, and then endomorphisms of the identity, which are these closed circles happening at the end there. And so really, I just need straight pointing up arrows here, but I've drawn this sigma just to indicate that we could have we could leave some non-trivial morphisms in the middle there. Okay, so we can do this just by applying the relations to pull all of the strands to their appropriate place. These are all of our indecomposables, and so now this enables us to prove a triangular decomposition of this height of the trace, which was done in both of the previous cases by whoever computed the trace, and me and Alistair Savage just extended this to the Frobenius-Heisenberg. And it's that the trace of the Frobenius-Heisenberg breaks down as the sum of a trace of an affine Reith product algebra, tensor trace of the opposite algebra of an affine Reith product algebra, and then whatever these endomorphisms of the monoidal identity are. And usually that ends up being a polynomial algebra. Okay, so this tells us that, and this is basically saying these are the P's, these are the up arrows, these are the down arrows, and then at the end there we have bubbles, which sort of act as polynomials. Okay, so this tells us that the trace of our Frobenius-Heisenberg is controlled by the traces of these affine Reith product algebras somehow. So our first step to actually computing what the trace of the Frobenius-Heisenberg is should be trying to compute what is the trace of these affine Reith product algebras. And the idea is that we want to somehow relate the trace of the affine Reith product algebra to the trace of just the Frobenius algebra. So the Frobenius algebra is finite dimensional, and it's somehow much easier to compute its trace just by writing down what all of the generators do. So we can do this, and this is sort of a nasty formula, I understand, but if we look at a Reith product algebra, so before I add in these polynomial generators, then the trace of that is I'll sum over all of the partitions of n, which tells n is telling me how many tensor factors I have. And then for each part of that partition, I'm using MacDonald notation here, so m sub I tells me how many parts of size I have. I can mix up any equal-sized parts. So if I have two parts of my partition, that two parts of my partition, then I can switch those blocks. And otherwise, I can't switch blocks between, say, a two-size part and a three-size part. And then within each block, I'm just getting a copy of the trace of my Frobenius algebra. So this is just telling us that we have a relatively easy relationship between the trace of this Reith product algebra and the trace of the Frobenius, which is easy to compute. So this is, here I assume my Frobenius was symmetric, and if it's not symmetric, then this statement gets a lot messier. I have to add size in various locations in this isomorphism, but it can be written down, and we have. Okay. So this is a Reith product algebra, and now how do I add the affine part in? Well, there's just a sort of general and not too difficult to see statement that if I take polynomials with coefficients in some algebra, then the trace of that is just polynomials with coefficients in the trace of the algebra. Okay, and again, this sort of gets more complicated with this psi floating around, but we can still write down a reasonable statement about it. So this tells us that adding in all of these polynomials, tensoring in this polynomial algebra to get the affine Reith product algebra, doesn't actually complicate the trace that this much. So this allows us to compute the trace of almost the affine Reith product algebra. So if you remember, there's this one non-trivial relation in the affine Reith product algebra that says that polynomial generators and Frobenius generators don't actually commute. So if I commute one past each other, I have to get a Nakayama automorphism. So this is, what I actually meant was, that's one thing. We're assuming our Nakayama automorphism is the identity here. If I compute a polynomial generator past an SI, then I pick up some scalar or some parameter in general. And that's the degenerate affine Hecke relation sort of messing with us. So actually, this is this allows us to compute the trace of the associated graded object of ANF, which is just polynomials with coefficients in the Reith product algebra. And then there's just a purely algebraic sort of abstract nonsense argument that we can use to lift a basis for the trace of the associated graded object to the trace of the filtered object, this larger ANF. All right, so this allows us now to compute the trace of any affine Reith product algebra in terms of trace of F, and that gives us a good size, a good idea of how big the trace of this Frobenius Heisenberg is because of our triangular decomposition. All right. So finally, this work is not completely done yet, but I'll describe sort of what we're working towards. So Wang defined a lattice W algebra, similar to these lattice Heisenberg algebras that I was talking about in the Grothendieck group. So as a vector space, this is just W1 plus infinity tensor the Frobenius algebra. And then the bracket is just, I use the normal bracket on the W1 plus infinity part, and I use the Frobenius algebra multiplication on the other part.
Your notation is switched. Here do you mean W1 plus infinity to be the Lie algebra, not its universal enveloping algebra, is that right? Or do you mean it to be the universal enveloping
algebra? I want it to be, I want universal enveloping algebras on both sides, so I can define a Lie algebra this way, and then.
Then you think you're, because W,
yeah.
You see what I mean?
Yeah, so I was using W1 plus infinity to mean universal enveloping algebra. I mean,
it matters if you take the tensor after or before forming universal.
Right, I want to take the enveloping algebra after doing this tensor. Fairly certain, yeah. So we can define a Lie algebra this way and then take its enveloping algebra. Okay. Yeah, so we get a Frobenius W algebra this way, and this is a sensible thing to expect to appear in the trace of this Frobenius Heisenberg category. So this proof is not done yet, but we have good evidence for it. And in the two cases that we do know, the F is equal to the ground field, which is the classical Heisenberg category, and F is equal to the Clifford algebra, which is the twisted Heisenberg category, then this isomorphism does hold. Okay. All right. And I'll just mention, so I've sort of mentioned this with each of the previous isomorphisms, but we're attempting to get a handle on this isomorphism in the same way. We do have Fock space representations defined on both sides here, and those Fock space representations are isomorphic. So we have two isomorphic faithful representations, and we're hoping to be able to use the actions of these two algebras on either side to match generators and get an isomorphism up top. So there are some difficulties here. For example, this algebra that I haven't really talked about at all, the endomorphisms of the identity, is a little bit more complicated for a general Frobenius algebra than it is for the twisted Heisenberg or for the normal Heisenberg case. But this is the hope, at least. Okay. So this is what I'm working on regarding traces of Heisenberg categories, and then I'll just mention briefly at the end that there is another decategorification functor that I consider in my research called the center. And the center is just taking these endomorphisms of a monoidal identity object. In this vector space case, the monoidal identity is just the one-dimensional vector space, and so the center is just the complex numbers. But more generally, in these Heisenberg categories, endomorphisms of the identity are these closed diagrams. So these could be bubbles like I had drawn earlier, or they could be these more complicated closed diagrams. And these are endomorphisms of the identity because there's no strands coming out of the bottom, none going into the top. So I'm mapping from the identity to the identity. Okay, and so in the two cases which exist, the center of these Heisenberg categories have been computed. So in the original Kovanov's case and in the twisted Heisenberg case. And in both of those situations, we get an algebra of symmetric or factorial symmetric functions. And there's some interesting connections to asymptotic representation theory of symmetric groups that come out of studying that. So another hope is to extend this to the Frobenius case, and we should be able to realize new algebras of Frobenius deformed symmetric functions this way. So this is sort of a future project that I'm interested in, but I think I will stop there.
So these lattice guys.
Which one, the W algebras or the?
W algebras.
Yeah.
What was Wei-Chung trying to do when he wrote these down? Like what?
Well, so he actually just wrote these down for group algebras, but there's no part of the definition doesn't work for an arbitrary Frobenius. And he was trying.
Associative algebra? You don't use your tensoring to associative algebras.
Yeah.
It's not a
Well, I mean, it is true that, like, nowhere on this page does the, like, trace appear.
I mean, all you're using is that differential operator on the circle in the associative algebra.
Yeah.
Yep, you can counter it with another associative algebra.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, is there some aspect of the structure that uses the Frobenius structure?
That uses the Frobenius structure?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, we're using the multiplication in the Frobenius algebra as part of the multiplication here.
Yes.
So, I mean, if you do this with, like, So, like, A Frobenius algebra is K of X mod X squared.
Yeah.
And the W algebra associated to that is abelian. All of the commutators are zero. Well, there's a W algebra part where we just have tensor 1, and then the part which has an X is
no, abelian. Because you have the product.
What?
Yeah. Some of the non-abelian W infinity algebra inside it.
Yeah.
And
right. So we either, we're getting a copy of it, or we're getting some more non-trivial Frobenius structure.
I guess the thing I'm asking is,
sure.
Is the Frobenius trace appearing here is just the underlying algebra?
I see. So it appears to just be the underlying algebra.
Okay.
This is sort of a central question we have going forward, that it seems like it should be the trace appearing here. But that doesn't work in the Clifford algebra case. So again, if we tensor with the trace of the Clifford algebra, then everything is zero here. All of these brackets are zero. Everything can, it's because we only have one generator C and it squares to zero.
I want to be clear, I don't mean the trace in the sense of capital T, I mean the lowercase t. The fact that you show, there's an extra piece of structure on F.
Right.
Which is necessary for defining the category.
I see.
Does it appear in this?
Here. I can't recall why this is defined for Frobenius algebras, but I believe that trace comes in when we're talking about defining representations of this thing.
I wonder, I mean, suppose we took F to be GMN,
Yeah. Then
we would find WN plus infinity. And we know WN plus infinity has a quantization to the alpha and yang. And the quantized algebra definitely does use the other structures of GMN.
Right.
So it could be that to deform away from this limit, you might.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Interesting question.